This is the NPR News Update for Monday, October 14. Hello, I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, parishioners sound off on church troubles, Vikings fans sound off on seat fees, an economic expert chimes in on the squabbles about the debt ceiling and government shutdown, and more is being done to teach the language of science. First, a University of St. Thomas professor is taking a leave of absence as a Twin Cities attorney files a lawsuit against him. The Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis says the Reverend Michael Keating is on temporary and voluntary leave and will not be exercising public priestly ministry. Attorney Jeff Anderson says he will file a lawsuit against Keating on behalf of a woman who says Keating engaged in sexual conduct with her when she was a minor. Reports of possible cover-ups and extra payments to clergy suspected of sexual misconduct have put the Archdiocese of St. Paul and Minneapolis under intense scrutiny in recent weeks. So how do parishioners feel about their church and their leaders? Reporter Rupa Shenoy talked with them at St. Francis Cabrini Church in Minneapolis and the Cathedral of St. Paul.
Vicky Deutsch, St. Paul. I like a lot of the things that the new Pope stands for. I wish the Archbishop here would change some of his thinking more in that direction. And I personally would like to see the Archbishop out of office.
My name is David Schnell, and I live in St. Paul. I respect the sovereignty of the Holy See, but we're in the United States of America, and this is a free country. It's a democracy. When stuff gets out, the answers are wanted desperately.
My name is Nick Kanan from Cottage Grove. I see the Archdiocese rather than acknowledging what appears to be some very troubling concerns or accusations is spending its time and energy in deflecting criticism and entrenching themselves in a position that is very defensive and is not in no way addressing the situation.
Beverly Dumas, and I'm from St. Paul, and I feel very, very sad for the church because when these things happen, all the people who are good people in the church get overshadowed by this horrible thing. And yet it needed to be exposed because it was the only way that this could ever change.
My name is Steve Rice, and I live in St. Paul. I think the Archdiocese is at a point where it's got to make some major adjustments to regain the confidence, particularly of the women of the entire upper metropolitan, the entire upper Midwest region. By the dozens of the women that I know, they're dropping out of the church because of their disgust with the church.
Ursula Kermeyer of North Oaks, Minnesota. It sounds like the church has taken the appropriate steps to put the right people in place. Hopefully this will clear out and flush out any corruption that's going on within the Archdiocese and that there'll be measures in place to stop that in the future.
Patrick, and the last name is Schmidt. I'm from West St. Paul. So the task force that's been formed, those who are on it will be effective. And I'm looking forward to them handling things independently. And, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. So what we have done as an archdiocese is things are getting better. God takes care of his church. And, you know, with the challenges, on Friday we found out about our new auxiliary bishop, who's Bishop-elect Andrew Cousins, and he is a great blessing. And amidst what we have as challenges, we also have hope, and he's one of the great rays of hope. So we're looking forward to that as well.
I'm John Schoenfelder. I'm from Burnsville. It just seems like the two cases that are even in the news is one from 10 years ago that was completely hashed out in the public. We all knew about it. And then the other one's about a public case where a priest went to jail from a year ago. I honestly don't understand what the big to-do is about it now. That's not a new scandal. It's rehashing old scandals. And it's like picking at an old wound just to throw salt on it. That's what it feels like to me. It feels like the media's chance to throw salt on an old wound to remind us that we're all sinners. And that, to me, is not news.
And that was John Schoenfelder from Burnsville. Rupa Shenoy got those voices for us. Vikings fans were back at the Metrodome yesterday for the first time since the team unveiled the details of its financing plan for a new stadium. The plan will have most fans paying an average of $2,500 each for a seat in the new building. That money goes to buy a personal seat license. For some, it's too much. Others, though, say it's the price of being a football fan, and they will pay. Tim Nelson talked with fans yesterday. He has this report.
The Metrodome is still drawing a crowd on Sunday afternoons, although fans are a little more subdued now that the Vikings are 1-4. But for Al Doherty, a fan from Hamel, enough is enough. He won't be renewing the season tickets he's had for years. It isn't football that soured him on the Vikings. It's that he thinks he'll have to come up with thousands of dollars to keep his seats in a new stadium. The team recently announced plans to sell 49,000 seat licenses to help pay off the Vikings' nearly $500 million contribution to a new field. The average price is $2,500, although Doherty thinks his end zone seats will be a lot more.
They're going to charge that. I'm done. I'm just going to enjoy this year. I got my tickets. I'm hoping to have some fun this year. I'm not going to participate in the stadium thing. I think it's gotten way out of hand.
That's true for many fans. They say the team's plans to charge one-time seat fees to get season tickets at a new stadium will simply price them out of the game. But others think there are good reasons to pay the Vikings thousands of dollars more for their seats. Ron Moore is a season ticket holder from Des Moines. He's a diehard Vikings fan, and he's ready to put his money where his seat is, about the 30-yard line.
Well, it's a cost of doing business.
He says he wants to be there for the next iteration of the Vikings, the successors to the legendary Super Bowl teams of Bud Grant and the middling hopefuls that have played in the Metrodome. For Moore, it's an investment in better football.
That's, I think this NFL is all about. It financially is franchise being able to afford to bring in the elite players to win. I mean, we got the best running back in the NFL, but we can't find the correct chemistry as far as quarterback and receivers to take us to the next level.
Others are more pragmatic about the idea. 30 years in the Metrodome have left Viking seats a complicated hash of ownership and tradition. It can be hard on game day to find someone sitting in seats they actually bought from the team.
The people that own these, he's been dead for like 40 years.
Larry Hendricks and his wife Catherine of New Prague were sitting in a set of corporate seats halfway up the lower level. Hendricks himself pays for two season tickets, owned by someone else, on the other side of the stadium. His daughter has a third set somewhere else. Hendricks says he'd pay a lot to simplify the transaction.
You know, when you can't transfer ownership, that's a bummer. If we could get the tickets in my own name, I definitely will do it. I won't even hesitate.
And for others, it's simply a matter of priorities. Chris Corliss, a season ticket holder from Bloomington, brought his dad Larry to the game on Sunday and says he'll buy seat licenses to keep doing that and not do something else.
My boat's getting old, and I was looking at, you know, I was saving money to buy a new one in the next couple of years, and that's probably going to just take that and put it to the side. And, you know, I'll end up making do with what I have.
Viking spokesman Jeff Anderson says the team is confident that, in the end, the seat licenses will sell.
Well, we've heard mixed reaction from fans. You know, we've obviously there's some concerns, and we've had some new folks sign up.
He says the team will lay out the actual prices and start selling the licenses early next year. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Of course, the Vikings were destroyed yesterday by the Carolina Panthers, 35-10, the final score, so probably not too many fans wanting to pay too much, at least not right now, to see the Vikings again. Well, with just a few days left before the federal government's supply of cash runs dangerously low, Minnesota senators remained in Washington for the weekend. In a speech on the Senate floor, DFLer Al Franken said the government shutdown and debt ceiling showdown have distracted lawmakers from vital issues such as education and job training.
Every day that the government stays shut down, every day we wake up under the threat of default, every day we spend focus on something that isn't working together to create jobs and rebuild the middle class is, in my mind, a tragedy.
Congressional Republicans have mostly backed off their demands the 2010 health care law be significantly altered before the government is reopened or borrowing limit raised, but the two parties are still at an impasse over spending levels. A Mayo Clinic expert says the federal government shutdown has slowed national surveillance of infectious diseases, including the influenza virus. Elizabeth Baer reports.
Most federal workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are furloughed because of the government shutdown. Greg Poland is a professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the Mayo Clinic. He says with flu season underway, it's unclear how many people have been infected and which strains of influenza are starting to emerge around the country.
So we really have no one who's able to collate all of the state level and international data and give us a comprehensive snapshot of what's the risk for us, what's circulating.
Poland says a prolonged shutdown could pose a risk for monitoring the spread of other outbreaks like measles and rubella. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
As talks to end the federal government shutdown continue in Washington, how much do you really know about the issues affecting the debate? And going forward, of course, we've been told if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling, the nation will default on its debts. How much do you know about that? Well, last week, reporter Mark Zedeklik talked to some people here in Minnesota about their understanding of the debate, and then he ran some of their ideas by one of the nation's top economic analysts.
A random sampling of some shoppers at the Mall of America turned up many different ideas about what Congress should do about the debt ceiling. 38-year-old Jeffrey Johnson, who lives in Minneapolis, said he's not worried about the government possibly defaulting on payment obligations.
Well, a deadbeat is an eye to beholder.
And Johnson sounded convinced that the federal government really doesn't need to pay all of its bills.
You know, same way we do it in our households. You know, we have certain bills we lag, you know, and certain bills we don't lag. Certain bills we keep paid up, certain bills we don't keep paid up.
30-year-old Katie Dinan of Burnsville agreed with Johnson that a U.S. default wouldn't necessarily trigger worldwide economic chaos.
I don't know. If I am late on a payment, am I forever damaged? No. I mean, I guess I don't know how it looks on a worldwide spectrum, but I'm not going to lie, I've defaulted on a payment, and here I am.
And 22-year-old Kente James from Chicago said it doesn't matter whether the debt ceiling is increased. He said we're all in trouble no matter what.
Because we're in debt. Whenever you're in debt, it's a problem. So it's going to be a problem regardless.
That's too pessimistic. We're not in trouble.
That's Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics. Zandi says the nation needs to address deficit spending, but he underscored that annual debt payments are very much under control. They amount to only about 2% of the nation's yearly gross domestic product. The GDP, as it's called, is the total dollar value of goods and services produced in the United States. As for the notion that a deadbeat is in the eyes of the beholder and defaulting on payment obligations wouldn't be a big deal, Zandi says that's entirely misguided.
The one thing that has made our economy the envy of the world is the fact that when we have our debts, we pay them. And it's that confidence among people who lend us money that we will repay them, that we're able to borrow when we need to and at a very, very low interest rate.
And Zandi says easy access to low-interest money is critical to the U.S. economy. A recent United Technologies National Journal poll found most Americans do not understand the debt ceiling. Zandi says that's concerning. He says it's not that complicated. It's simply a matter of the nation paying what it has already agreed to pay. The debt ceiling debate has nothing to do with new policies, new programs, or new spending.
I do worry that, more people aren't screaming about this, more business people and stock investors aren't more nervous about it, because what that means is there's just less pressure on lawmakers to do the right thing.
Some Republicans are trying to make the case that defaulting on payment obligations would not necessarily happen if the debt ceiling is not raised. They argue there is plenty of tax money coming in to meet debt payments and that Congress would simply have to cut unnecessary spending to make it all work. Zandi says that math just does not add up.
Even though we take in a lot of tax revenue and other revenue, it's not enough. In fact, just to give you a sense of it, last year, the budget deficit, which is the difference between how much we spend and how much we take in revenue, was over $600 billion. So that's a very large number, and that's a hole that can't be filled without borrowing.
Zandi says if the debt ceiling is not increased, and that's the unthinkable as far as he's concerned, people are going to find out what a big deal it would be for the U.S. to run out of money. He says stocks would plunge, interest rates would rise, and that it would snowball, sparking panic in financial markets.
Mark Zedeklik on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Members of a state Senate panel visit 9 communities this week to hear proposals for public construction projects. DFL Senator Leroy Stumpf chairs the Capital Investment Committee. He says the requests for next year's bonding bill already exceed $2 billion. Democrats need help from Republicans to reach the supermajorities needed to pass the bonding bill.
It'll be tough in the sense that we're going to have to set aside a lot of projects that should be funded, but I think we'll work together in a much better way this coming session than in 2013.
Leroy Stumpf there. House Republicans blocked an $800 million bonding bill in the closing days of the 2013 session. They argued the package of projects was too big for a non-bonding year. Voter pre-registration for this fall's elections ends tomorrow. Brant Williams reports.
State officials say Minnesotans should re-register to vote if they've moved or changed their name since the last time they voted, or if it's been longer than 4 years since the last time they cast a ballot in an election. Voters can now also register online on the Minnesota Secretary of State's website. They can also register at the polls on Election Day. Minneapolis city officials are encouraging voters to check the city's website for a sample ballot. There will be a record 35 mayoral candidates for voters to choose from. All city council seats, as well as several other races, will also be on the ballot. And thanks to ranked choice voting, voters will be able to pick their first, second, and third choices. Absentee voting has started for people who will not be able to vote in person on November 5th. In Minneapolis, absentee voters can submit their ballots in person at City Hall until the last Saturday before the election. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Charter schools with mostly white students are increasing in the Twin Cities suburbs. That's according to a new study from the University of Minnesota. Here's our Tim Post.
The report's author, Myron Orfield, says there's been a 40% increase in predominantly white charters in racially diverse suburbs over the last 5 years.
Many of the first and second ring suburbs where the schools have become more diverse, you have a disproportionate number of very white charter schools.
Orfield says the charters are contributing to a sort of white flight from more diverse suburban district schools. Brian Sweeney with the nonprofit charter startup group Charter School Partners says families don't choose charters to escape racially diverse schools.
Most parents choose charter schools for academic programs that may not be available in their district schools.
The U of M's research finds Twin Cities charters overall underperform district schools and are becoming more racially segregated. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Rising passenger traffic at the Twin Cities Airport's Humphrey Terminal has attracted more food vendors. Martin Moylan has more.
Last year, about 3.3 million passengers used the terminal. That's more than twice the number who used the facility just 5 years ago. There used to be just one restaurant there. This past spring, three eateries, including a Subway sandwich shop, opened. And now Certix has opened a 55-seat full-service restaurant at the terminal. Airport spokeswoman Melissa Skovronsky says airlines have dramatically ramped up their use of the Humphrey Terminal in recent years.
In the last 5 years, we have had Southwest come in, as well as Spirit Airlines, and Sun Country has come out of bankruptcy, and they believe that they will be able to expand their schedule here over the next several years.
The airport is considering adding additional gates at the Humphrey Terminal. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Science, technology, engineering, and math disciplines will generate tens of thousands of jobs in Minnesota in the next decade. Many of those careers require knowledge of the code language computer programs run on. Our reporter Elizabeth Baer, we go back to her. She found a group of software engineers and programmers in Rochester who are trying to make computer programming more mainstream by teaching young kids how to code.
7-year-old Jaitanya Gathi stands at the end of a long table, his eyes glued to a computer screen. His little hands can't quite reach all the keys on the keyboard, so he uses his index fingers to scroll the laptop's trackpad.
It's supposed to be a colorful ball of cat fur, which always changes colors and bounces off walls, leaving a colorful trail behind it, like a spider web.
Gathi and two dozen other students are learning to use a program called Scratch, which lets them snap blocks together to bring animated characters to life. Each block represents a programming instruction, so kids don't have to worry about typos. It's sort of like building a structure with Legos in the physical world. His dad, Surya Gatti, is a software developer at IBM and one of the group's mentors.
Can you explain what you were trying to do here?
I'm trying to make a color-changing furball that draws with color. Automatically, it's supposed to do that.
But instead of bouncing off the walls, the furball floats off the screen.
I need you to define what these are, right? How does the computer, how does the Scratch program know it shouldn't go beyond this?
It doesn't know it until we tell it.
So I need you to tell the computer or Scratch, say, if you go beyond this, come back. Can you do that?
Within a minute, the younger Gatti, who's been programming since he was 5 and a half, solves the problem. His colorful furball starts to bounce. The elder Gatti says it's taken his son a few years to really understand he's the one telling the computer what to do.
Having a mindset, getting the programmer mindset, it's like telling the computer to do something so that others can use it. That was a difficult one to get.
The Scratch program was launched at MIT in 2007. It's one of a few programs some Rochester professionals are using to get kids excited about computer coding. Jim Rogers chairs Mayo Clinic Ventures, which manages the clinic's intellectual properties and patents. He helped bring the coding group to Rochester. He sees the free classes as a small but important first step toward diversifying tech jobs in Rochester, where one of the major employers, IBM, has had ongoing layoffs for years.
We would like to see more jobs related to computer programming in town. Not necessarily Mayo jobs, but other companies who want to either locate here or want to take advantage of the talent pool here.
In the last decade, science, technology, engineering, and math jobs have grown 3 times faster than other fields. In Minnesota, state officials expect these disciplines to generate 70,000 jobs between 2009 and 2019. Rogers says reaching out to kids in math and science is also about making Rochester, the state's fastest growing city, an attractive place for some of these kids to return to.
We need younger folks to want to come back once they go away to college to stay here in Rochester. For them to stay here in Rochester, they have to have meaningful jobs.
Replenishing the workforce in southeast Minnesota is one reason to teach kids how to code. But Karen Brennan, an assistant professor at the Harvard School of Education, says it's also about teaching kids how to see the world in a whole new way. She says kids learn how to apply logic and problem solving to larger concepts by learning how to code with the Scratch program, which she helped develop.
Even just the practice of testing and debugging, you know, programming, nothing ever works the first time you build something in code. And so developing those practices around in testing what you've built against the model of what you had in your head, you know, what's wrong with it, how do you fix it? That's another big category of activities.
Brennan says after mastering the Scratch program, students go on to learn more complex programming languages. And she's convinced teaching kids to code is as important to their future as learning to read or write.
That's Elizabeth Baer in Rochester. Thanks for encoding the NPR News update today. I'm Phil Picardi, back with more Minnesota news on Tuesday.